Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Peter Brantley. He's the executive director, I think I have that title right, of the Internet Archives. Peter, how are you?
Good, thanks. And I'm actually the director of the book server project at the Internet Archive. Brewster Kahle, the founder of the Internet Archive, would still hold the nominal title of or the equivalent of executive director.
Well, thanks for correcting me, because I actually did have it wrong. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what the Internet Archive actually does, because I think there probably are many people listening who may not know what it is.
Sure. The Internet Archive is a very special, unique not-for-profit that was founded by Brewster Kahle, who's an Internet pioneer. Brewster came out of MIT and started a company called Waze, Wide Area Information Service, which was an early pre-browser means of distributing content and actually was meant to provide a vehicle for distributing monetized content, and worked with some of the leading publishers at the time, ranging from New York Times to Encyclopedia Britannica. Didn't quite make it, given the lack of infrastructure on the net, and wound up, I believe, with AOL. Brewster then started a search company that was acquired by Amazon. And in between those activities, Brewster started creating this not-for-profit, the Internet Archive, and the intent of the archive originally was to provide a vehicle to preserve information from the web forever, for eternity, and try to figure out best efforts to do that. So the prime service that the Internet Archive has done is to provide something called the Wayback Machine at wayback.org, which is an effort to catalog how the web has changed over the last now 15 years or greater. And so being able to turn back the clock and look at what some microsystems might have looked like in 1998, for example, is a service of the Wayback Machine. Since that time, Brewster initiated additional services. The Internet Archive is a repository for many gigabytes worth of video and film archives, of music, as well as the home for about 1.9 million and growing digitized public domain books, which is probably where I spend most of my time.
Well, so, and just out of curiosity, where does all the server space for this come from if it's a nonprofit? Are you getting donated server space, or do you actually raise money and then purchase server space?
We cobble things together from a variety of sources. We're fortunate that the Brewster Kahle Foundation helps provide some baseline support to the archive. Our primary revenue-generating source is actually web crawling, web archiving on behalf of others. So, for example, a national government might contract with the Internet Archive to preserve a copy of the Australian web domain or the French web domain, and then we would provide them a copy or store a copy on their behalf. So we obtain some resources that way. Most of our other activities are actually break-even, and we try very hard not to widen our deficit, but we're also not in the business of making money in a traditional commercial sense purely to make money, and so we live very lean and try to avoid expenses whenever possible. Storage is something that we benefit from the curve that allows us to put half a petabyte of storage in a single rack today, and hopefully in the next cycle of storage would be putting a petabyte in that rack. So the storage space requirements decline at the same time that our storage usage grows. So there's a little bit of trade-off in cost there.
That's pretty interesting. It means that ultimately you're in the kind of digital library world, and that's sort of, I guess that's your background in some respects. What did you do before? Kind of what prepared you for this life, it's in your life, for this particular experience?
My background is probably primarily in IT and information technology, and I have served in a variety of roles in digital libraries, primarily in academic environments, which is where the concept of a digital library was perhaps first developed and where it spread. So I managed technology teams, essentially led the equivalent of product development in a not-for-profit environment, and I do also have some publishing background as well. Many, many years ago at Random House, I was working in a position that was, in charge of systems for the mass market group. So I think, you know, when I look at what I do now, it's all driven by an interest in media, an interest in books, and particularly how technology has influenced the transformation in the industries that are important to the spread of information more broadly. So things like libraries and publishing, archives, and to a lesser extent, museums, all very much concerned with, at heart, many of the same issues.
And I assume you think about and deal with the issue of access. You know, it seems to be that that kind of is at the crux of maybe the contradiction between publishing in our world, in the world of books being sold for money, because that's the way things work. You have libraries which are dedicated to access, whereas commercial publishers are dedicated to profit. And those goals are sometimes contradictory, which I think you at least seem to, it seems to be part of your work to be dealing with that contradiction.
Yeah, I think that's a nice way of putting it. There are sometimes a profoundly complicating set of interactions between the goals of libraries and the goals of publishers, and thinking about publishers writ large, both books, journals, newspapers even. We all have at heart the same desire, which is to put information in the hands of people who can use it and benefit from it. But the ways that we drive those activities are somewhat different. You know, there are many librarians, I think, who, in response to the question, what do you do for a living? You know, one very valid response is, I remove barriers to access for information for as many people as possible. And that's certainly, I think, one of the goals of the Internet Archive, which is to make information as broadly available as possible to as many people as possible. And yet, at the same time, that is also a goal of publishing. There is a certainly for commercial entities a need to generate revenue to cover not only expenses but to grow or to deepen investment into new activities. And so, you know, I think at heart, particularly as the sort of impact of recent technologies has sort of steamrolled over past practice, I think a growing set of core activities is common to these kinds of industries.
Well, yeah, I think, it sort of gets me thinking about, maybe it's just a sort of thing that I think about may not be on your mind, but copyright, for example, is, in the last 100 years, copyright has more or less been transformed. When it was first introduced into Western society hundreds of years ago, the idea was that the society was granting to creators a right to own temporarily the fruits of their intellectual and creative labor. And then it would be released into the society for the benefit of all. So copyright was trying to recognize the value of intellectual property. and to both to the individual and to the society. But what we have now in the last 100 years or so, particularly in the West, you know, in the U.S., the extension of copyright as a recognition that the owner of the copyright wants to exploit it for a longer period of time. And that kind of, to me, symbolizes the conflict between access and the notion of availability to society for the common good or the public good versus the need for a private entity to own something for profit, which we obviously want to support. We want people to be able to make money so that they can continue their careers as creative individuals or corporations. But, what do you think, I guess this is a really long-winded question, what do you think about the length of the term of copyright?
I think the term of copyright is ridiculously overextended and way too long. I think that, you know, probably the original conception was 14 years possible renewal for another 14 under certain circumstances. You know, to abide by the original aims of the copyright the philosophy, which you've enunciated well. So I think there are a lot of ways that copyright is really badly broken for the digital environment. And this is certainly an area where I think there's going to be, some innate conflict between libraries and other cultural institutions and companies which do make their living off of selling content because they do need that. They need some kind of revenue stream to continue to produce content. They don't necessarily need a revenue stream off content itself, but they do need some revenue. And so, how that gets enacted as we move forward, I think, is a really difficult question that we really haven't been able to settle. And I think, sometimes we get too stuck on thinking about the problem just with copyright itself as a bundle of laws. But the fact of the matter is, in a digital environment, it's more than just copyright as a piece of legislation that's broken. It's that we don't really have a rights infrastructure in place that facilitates our understanding of who might have rights to particular kinds of content for certain kinds of uses in particular places and at particular times. And I think, as we move out of our really almost 19th century understanding of, pencil the publication into the ledger kind of rights cataloging that we have now, and more toward a distributed network way of making assertions about rights and making assertions about attributes of rights, for content that's increasingly going to be distributed across the network and not held in discrete items that are physical and packaged in a nice, neat way, manner, then I think we'll be able to sort of open up the very complicated questions of, how can we provide as many points of monetization as possible in the flow of information. And I don't mean that in a sort of an evil, let's tax information wherever we can way, but in a way of if we fully understand what a rights profile looks like for particular pieces of content, we can, I think, more accurately or better leverage our ability to figure out how to encourage the creation of that kind of content in an ongoing basis by figuring out the best ways to monetize it.
Well, and it is really, I think you've hit on something that's really important, and that is that in many ways the technology, the digital technology that has been adopted, through the Internet kind of hyper speed has outstripped many of the structures that were created for a prior and actually evolved over many, many years in prior incarnations of technology development so that, you had, for instance, in the music business, you have ASCAP and BMI, which emerged in the 20th century as a way of coping with radio, essentially, and then later adapt, other media. But it's almost like the Internet just exploded across the world, and there was, and there really has been not enough work done in structures to keep up with the changes that have occurred.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, one of the things that's most interesting is that on top of the technology, we're seeing the transformation in the kinds of experiences that people expect in an information-rich environment. And I was thinking about this earlier today because I had a call from a friend of mine, Michael Edson, who's responsible for digital strategy at the Smithsonian. And Michael's trying to think through what a strategy for Smithsonian Commons looks like, you know, how to open up the museum to as many people as possible. And when I was talking with him about some of the challenges of that concept, one of the things I realized that was that maybe 5 or 6 years ago, really not that long ago, when I worked for the University of California Digital Library, we were still pretty much thinking about certain kinds of experiences happening for certain kinds of content. So that we would have digitized books, we would have digitized pictures and images, we would have digitized scholarly papers, and we were just beginning to try to think from the back end, from the system side, how might we start to integrate some of those functions so that we could level them out. But what was too early then, and I think what we're increasingly expecting now as users, as individuals, is that instead of thinking about hopping from one place to another place, and each place we hop to, we have a different experience. Instead, slowly, and I think almost invisibly, we're growing to expect that we're carrying around an information profile with us. And that, in fact, as we move from information source to information source, we're changing that information itself, right, and moving it with us. And an example of this, I think, sort of a limited but neat example, was that, you know, just, I guess, this last week, Apple came out with the Ping Music service, which is intended to be a social service for music recommendation. And one of the things that they were slammed on was that people couldn't easily integrate their Facebook social graph or their Twitter social graph into Ping. It wasn't apparent how you would do that. And I think what's fascinating there is not simply the desire for people to import a whole bunch of people from one place into another, but the presumption that there's a set of social relationships in that case that I should be able to almost transparently bring along with me. And I think in a similar situation, one of the things that we need to think about in the publishing community and the library community as we start developing new services is how do we encourage those kinds of linkages between experiences so that people can move parts of their environment with them, not focusing on the site as an experience, but on what people are expecting to want to do. And I think an example in publishing and in libraries is a concept of a portable bookshelf. If people could create a list of books, magazines, journals, and other content and refer to that from the perspective of many different services, whether the service was Google Books or Barnes & Noble or Goodreads or Library Thing or Internet Archives Project Open Library, we should be able to share parts of that experience of that bookshelf on a per-person basis. And the individual should be able to share that experience to other users in their social environment. And I think if we can start thinking about how to break down, or it's not the right way of putting it perhaps, but of ways of allowing some permeability between the kinds of generated experiences that users have from one service to another, and allowing that generated experience to spill out a bit on the flattened plane that internet technology makes available, then I think we'll be doing something valuable, something worthwhile for users.
Well, it sounds like the Vulcan mind meld, essentially. that what you're, at least as I'm envisioning what you're saying, is that almost like, you know, with Peanuts and the Pigpen character who carries dirt around with him all, you know, everywhere he goes, you know, kind of you'd trail around with you in all of your incarnations in various venues, your kind of complete set of mediated experiences, whether they're, you know, media driven or otherwise, and they would be kind of a digital signature that would not necessarily be human readable, but could be machine readable. And that, you know, so if I met you in a digital environment, we could, and you'd have control over what amount of things you'd want to share with people. It would kind of automatically connect your profile to the profile that you're viewing, and you could find all these interesting linkages and comparisons that would enable you to communicate together.
I guess I see it in practice probably a little bit more distributed and less holistic or centered around an individual user. I, you know, doubt that there's going to be a service where I literally dump all of this stuff together and then I can point various services to it. Rather, some of my experience is going to be in one service provider or one publisher context. Part of my experience will be in others. But my ability to ensure that I can move that or share that information between those services, that I can link that information together, will be present to a greater extent than it is now. There's a concept that's relatively dominant now in digital libraries and growing in many other contexts called linked data. And I think that that's a pointer to part of what I'm thinking about, where linked data is a concept where when you have a repository of information, whether it's books or other content like that, or also accumulated user experience or profile information that's under their control, that there are ways of exposing that out through regularized, abstracted forms like APIs, programming interfaces, that allow other services to say, oh, I can pick up that piece of data and combine it with this other piece of data because they share a common element. And then I can build a bigger service combining these two pieces of data. So linked data is not something that a single service provider has to do beyond making the data that they have available in regularized ways.
Right. Now, do you think this means, though, that the only way that this would happen is if people, if companies would be able to find a way for this to be a profit-generating activity? Or are you thinking of this as more in the nonprofit realm?
Oh, I guess neither. I don't see this as revenue biased in one way or another. I think that what we will see is new services emerging and feeding off of the ability to integrate data and information to a greater extent. And it's up to all of us to figure out what those services look like, and to the extent that they need revenue for sustainability, then there will be ways of providing that revenue or of charging for those services. But I think this vision that the Internet continues to provide us, and I definitely do not think that, for example, the web is dead, but that the vision that the Internet provides us is one where by utilizing relatively simple, lightweight standard protocols and abiding by certain common expectations, there's a level of interoperability and flatness, a word I used previously, sort of an availability of information to people that we haven't had before.
Well, but do you think, I guess that's another point that you kind of alluded to earlier with Ping, do you feel that this the notion of that Apple has put forth of more devices that lead to consumption and experience in more controlled discrete ways that are less internet application related but more device ecosystem related. Do you feel that there's a conflict there, that you know, that the web eventually has to triumph over the kind of closed networks experience, or do you feel like there's a way that they can integrate, that there really isn't a conflict?
Somewhere in between, I guess. I certainly am not a fan of walled garden, and I generally am skeptical of the commentary that suggests that the more that we do those things, the better off we are, because we can provide a more custom or tailored or better experience within those gardens. And I do think that that's to some extent true, that Apple can clearly provide a tailored, controlled environment in some of its service and content ecosystems compared to the wild, woolly internet. But I don't see it as an either-or, that the walled garden approach necessarily takes away from the overall function of the net. And I think, you know, we really only have walled gardens because the internet exists as a foundation. And if people want to create walled gardens, and if they're able to monetize those walled gardens because they do provide a superior experience for people, then fine. You know, that will continue to be a possible, you know, option for content and service providers on the network. But beyond it, under it, as a foundation, there needs to be a common set of expectations for how data is moved. Apple does not close itself off from the internet. You know, Apple fully participates in a wide range of standard development. They participate widely in an internet system. And you don't see Apple suddenly saying, enough of this web stuff, we're not going to distribute browsers anymore. It's not, you know, their mindset at all, right? They're one of the primary investors in developing next generation web rendering capability. And so they're making a big investment in the web. And I think that all of us who are invested now in utilizing distributed network technology have to acknowledge that that's a substrate upon which we can all build in different ways.
So do you think this also, I mean, that kind of, this discussion also can apply to the book or the music or the video or film environment, as you know, in this sort of discussion of product versus experience, you know, and this is something that I think in the book business there's a lot of thinking about, maybe underlying the emergence of digital publishing, and that is, you know, does the web in its distributed experience format undermine the notion of a physical product, such as a book has become, where it has the traditional beginning and middle and end. I mean, I'm not saying story is necessarily undermined, but that the container that a book is made into, which is a physical product, it has the result of, you know, a certain form of technological advances over a period of time. Now the web experience changes the way both creator and consumer can experience written information, and it sort of changes your expectation of what the container might be.
So yeah, I guess, absolutely.
So
yeah.
When people talk about books now, are we simply using a language that we are given because it's one that we were culturally, you know, I mean, it's been the lingua franca to think of a book as physical object. We transform that terminology as we apply it to the reading experience in digital environments. But I guess my question is, can you imagine, or do you imagine, that will change over the next, say, you know, 20, 50, 100 years, so that 100 years from now they may be using the word book, but they mean something completely different?
Yeah, it's well beyond me to imagine 100 years from now, or that will be that would be really a separate conversation that we should have. I'm happy to fantasize about that. But I think, you know, even in the near term, like now, you know, I think publishing is actually in a sort of a deeper quixotic situation than it would have ever anticipated before. Because sort of fundamentally, we don't in publishing, we don't have a core product anymore. You know, the book, you know, I think for decades we had an understanding of what a book would be like. We had an understanding of what a paperback would be like. We had an understanding about what a trade book would be like and so forth. And they essentially conform to a certain product specification. And now as we're moving into a much more transparent digital age, it's not at all, I think, apparent to people what the book means. And even if the book is, as you suggested, even if necessarily the book is a relevant concept. And we are seeing the sort of expected near-term translation of a paper book into a digital instantiation by, you know, making sure that it's digitally available so that it's essentially the same kind of experience. And as we start to build enhanced books, right, sort of packages of content that have some video in them or other kinds of information assets, we're still sort of moving along on the assumption that we can build these things, these packages of enriched material, and then we move those from place to place, from a reader to a browser to whatever. But, you know, I think really the sort of the longer-term trend here is to recognize that things that are part of an experience, a book experience, whatever you want to call it, they don't need to live in the same digital container. And that one of the fundamental, you know, affordances that the internet provides as infrastructure is the ability to point to resources that are wildly scattered around, that can update themselves in real time with locational information, with you know, current data, and so forth. And so that, you know, a book can be a living experience, first of all, and also distributed across the net in a form that we haven't really thought of before. And so, you know, when you start thinking about 5 years out, what is a book, you know, I think we need to recognize that the trend is for whatever a book is, you know, maybe we need a new term, I don't know, but let's call it a book, is going to be referencing a lot of information that could live anywhere in the world. And that information may not be static and may be updatable. And so I think this trend to put books on the web and have them really as full-fledged web objects is just beginning now. You know, we're just at the threshold of being able to imagine, you know, how we might create, describe, and sell those kinds of experiences. But I don't think that, you know, 5 years out, we'll see in a dominant fashion, at least, books still just sort of as purely, particularly enhanced books, as purely self-contained objects. I think that the trend is going to be to take advantage of network infrastructure to broaden the book and enrich the book and to make the book more social in a way that we just have not been able to do before.
I think that's great. And really, that's actually the perfect point for us to end. It's been really terrific talking to you, and I've enjoyed this a lot. I hope we'll be able to talk again. This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks. I've been talking to Peter Brantley from the Internet Archive. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.